Welcome to the Rogue Startups Podcast, where two startup founders are sharing lessons learned and pitfalls to avoid in their online businesses. And now, here's Dave and Craig.
All right, welcome to episode 113 of Rogue Startups. This week, Dave and I have a special guest on that I think is going to be a really nice and interesting, potentially different slant from a lot of the topics that we've had before. This week, we have David Rosenthal on. And David is going to be talking all about the world of venture capital and funded companies. So, David, how you doing?
Hey, doing great. Thanks for having me on, guys.
No, it's my pleasure. So, I guess in all fair disclosure, David and his partner Ben are customers of Podcast Motor and are happy customers of Podcast Motor. And that's kind of how we got hooked up. And they run the Acquired podcast. So, I guess first, you want to talk a bit about kind of yourself and your podcast that you're into?
Yeah, sure. So I've been in the VC world for a number of years now. I started about 7 years ago, back in 2010, at a firm in Seattle called Madrona Venture Group. And Madrona is a generalist Series A type firm, $300 million fund. They're on their sixth fund now. I joined when they were just finishing their third fund, and invests in enterprise and consumer and health IT and basically anything broadly technology enabled, and mostly companies located in the Pacific Northwest, although occasionally elsewhere. And so I spent about 7 years there, started as an associate, and then was promoted to a principal and worked with all different types of companies. And while I was there, I met my podcast co-host, Ben Gilbert. So Ben was part of an initiative that we started at Madrona called Madrona Labs. And Ben was one of the co-founders there. And the idea was we'd had this cool experience that I was also part of at Madrona, where we started a company called Rover.com, along with an entrepreneur in residence who we had with us, Aaron Easterly, who's currently the CEO of Rover. And Rover is a marketplace for dog sitting and dog walking. And it turned out to be a great success. So that was a case where venture capital was involved from literally day one of the company. And so our partner, Greg Gottesman, thought, what if we systematized a way to do more of this? And so he brought Ben in. They created Madrona Labs to work on prototyping products and companies, and then sort of birthing companies within Madrona. That worked so well that they spun that idea out, and Greg and Ben and a few other folks started Pioneer Square Labs, which is a dedicated incubator and startup studio dedicated to doing that. So Ben and I intersected there. So we have all different types of experience in the startup building and funding ecosystem. And we started the podcast Acquired that looks at the exits that companies have and sort of the other end of the funnel. Where do we want to get to ultimately when we're building and financing companies? And so Acquired, we're on our 49th episode, I think, now. And each episode looks at either an acquisition that has happened in the technology space. We've done YouTube, we've done Android, we've done Instagram, we've done AOL Time Warner, many famous ones, some good, some bad, or an IPO. So we just covered the Atlassian IPO. We've got the Stitch Fix IPO coming up. We've done Amazon. We've done the Facebook IPO. And there's so many lessons in there about, you know, where these companies, how they start and where they get to at the end and the journey along the way.
Wow, that's a lot.
Sorry for the long intro.
No, that's great. I'm just processing everything that you had there. So I was sort of flipping through your list of stuff in the podcast there. And of course, one of personal interest in the recent past here, because I was investing in both Amazon and Whole Foods, was the Whole Foods acquisition there and how that all went down.
Our biggest episode ever. It was really fun. We neither Ben nor I had any idea it was going to happen, as did most of the world. And then when it got announced, we actually recorded an emergency episode that afternoon talking about all the history behind it. And there's some really fascinating stories, including that Amazon actually owns all of the assets and the web address of Webvan, of the totally failed, you know, posterchild.com grocery delivery failure. And then, you know, 10 plus years later, they end up acquiring Whole Foods and it comes full circle.
Well, hopefully they've learned a lot of lessons there. I'm very anxious to see how it is moving forward when I walk into my local Whole Foods here to go shopping, I see the subtle little changes that show up there. And hey, Prime members, look at this deal you get over here, and subtle stuff about price changes and things like that. So that's sort of like being part of an acquisition on a daily basis here, and how it directly impacts my life. It's kind of fascinating to watch. So
yeah, we'll see what they do with it.
Hopefully all good things. All right. So let's jump in here. So as you know, Craig and I are both single founder bootstrap types here. And, you know, there's definitely some, certainly in our community, maybe less so in the VC community, but there's contention between funded companies and, you know, bootstrap companies. And so I think bootstrapped businesses view VC with some suspicion, some derision, not necessarily justifiable, but, you know, it's there and it exists. So I'm curious, as a VC and your experience in this space, how do you view bootstrap businesses? And, you know, do you get a lot of people that come to you with just the idea and they've got nothing else, and you found them and bring them up? Or do you get businesses that are established and then they say, hey, look, we've gotten this to a certain point, but we can't get any further unless we get funding here. Can you help us get funding? So what are the criteria for you guys to look at a bootstrap business and say, yeah, this makes some sense to take some outside investment in, when you would actually consider investing in them?
Yeah, totally. Well, from the VC side of the table, you know, I would say there is no suspicion at all about viewing bootstrap businesses and founders. I mean, if anything, you know, we know how hard it is, you know, just from watching all and working with all the founders we work with, how hard it is to build a business when you're taking, you know, millions, sometimes tens of millions of dollars of investment and partners to help you do it. Doing it on your own is, you know, no matter what scale you're at, is just such a difficult thing, you know, as you guys obviously know. And, you know, there's no, you know, I've no greater respect for anything in business than starting, you know, a venture and building a business yourself. It's very, very difficult. But I think that said, you know, to your question of, I guess a little bit like, what's the difference in how and when would somebody who has bootstrapped a business, you know, think about taking venture capital? I think it really, it depends on a number of factors, but it really depends on, is there, do you feel like taking investment, either just purely the capital or the other things that come along with the capital, would really help you accelerate building value for your shareholders, whether that's just you or any other, you know, your co-founders or your employees or any other shareholders you have in the business? And what I mean by that is, like, just to take money to grow a little faster or fund some projects, it can work, but is probably not the best path. And instead, I think when you're thinking about taking professional venture capital, and what I mean by that is, you know, an established firm that has raised institutional money that is looking to invest in high growth startups, you have to think about what their motivations are and whether there's going to be an alignment. And so for most venture capital firms, they're looking to take the money that they've raised across the entire fund and multiply that by roughly three to four times is the kind of target that they're shooting for. Now, they understand that a bunch of the companies they invest in will fail and they will lose the money they invest, and they're okay with that. But that means that the ones that succeed, they have to return many more than three times the money. So when VCs look at a business and an investment, they're typically asking themselves, if I invest 1 million, 2 million, 10 million in this business, is there a path that I can see to getting 10 times that back at an exit, or even more than 10 times? So then as a founder, when you're thinking about taking that money, you have to ask yourself, like, do I also see that path? And do I see that if I raise this money, it can really help take my business to 10 times or more the size that it is now? And you have to understand that from a VC's perspective, although you ideally, you know, you want a good partner, and the best VCs, I think, do work really hard for all of their portfolio companies. At the end of the day, their business is, like I said, some are going to survive and thrive and some won't. But as a founder, you only have one company and one business. And so once you're in business with VCs, their decision tree is going to be pushing you towards going for that 10x multiplier. But that might make you to take some, make some decisions that create some binary risk for your company, where if you fail, the company might fail. Whereas if you keep going along on the bootstrap path, you have much more certainty and control over your business.
David, I want to peel back the proverbial onion on something you said early on in that, which is that taking outside funding is not just about the money, but the other things that an external party might bring to the table that can help your business. So I think it's very fair to say it's not just the cash influx that you would have to hire people and get resources, but some other maybe intangible things that an external partner can bring to the table. What are some of those things that you've seen work out particularly well?
Yeah, totally.
For an established business that brings in funding?
Well, I think there are a few categories, and I think it's a little bit dependent on stage. So, you know, some companies that take venture capital very, very early in their life cycle, you know, like Rover that I was speaking about, and those are some, you know, for me, the most fun companies to work with. You know, it's really everything, because you're bringing on a true partner at that point in building the business. I mean, the business doesn't exist yet. And so you're bringing someone on that, you know, certainly will help you make strategic decisions, but is also going to be feel a real responsibility for constructing everything you need. So, you know, that's your employee base, that's your initial customers, that's any kind of partnerships you need that can help establish your go-to-market strategy. That's often just advice and sort of shared experience with other companies and employees and entrepreneurs in the VC firm's portfolio about, hey, I have this engineering challenge as I'm trying to build this product. You know, what? Who else has faced similar challenges? So that's much more relevant in the early stage. But even later on, I mean, a great example we did, I mentioned on our Acquired podcast, we did an episode on the Atlassian IPO. That's one of, if not perhaps the most successful bootstrapped company in the technology space. They did not raise any primary venture capital throughout the whole life of the company, and then went public, and now they're valued at almost $15 billion. Along the way, and what I mean by primary venture capital, the company itself did not raise any money. So they didn't issue any new shares and sell them to investors. But a few years before they did go public, they ended up taking a $60 million investment from Accel Partners, the venture capital firm here in Silicon Valley. And that was the founders themselves sold some of their shares and got some liquidity to Accel. But part of the reason that they did that, and they talk about this, was they didn't need the money, the capital, to grow the business. They had plenty of that. They were very profitable. But they were finding that as they were getting larger and they were starting to talk to more and more enterprise level customers, that they would look at the business and say, you know, who are you guys? You know, you're bootstrapped by two, you know, recent college grads. You know, you're down in Australia. Can I trust you?
Australia's peopled with criminals.
Yeah, exactly. Can I trust you that you're going to make a great product and be a great partner to me as I build my business, you know, and my business may be like Ford or, you know, like SpaceX. And so they felt that, you know, yes, there were liquidity issues for the two of them as founders, but also that bringing on one of the marquee Silicon Valley firms would really give them a lot of legitimacy as they went out and talked to customers, not to mention recruiting executives and other things. So it really does depend, but it can be a lot beyond just the capital.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Now, this is sort of a follow-on to that follow-on. Basically, there's a common issue of goal alignment here. How do you sit down with a founder and find out what your goals are and what their goals are, and how does everybody get aligned in a way that makes everybody successful and everybody happy? Because I think that's one of the great tensions that exists with VC and founders, is everybody's got different goals, like you alluded to earlier, where VCs might come up with that decision tree. You said, here's a binary risk for the company. Well, the founder could really get screwed from that if they took that risk and it turned out poorly for them. So what are some things that you have seen that have worked well to make this work better for everybody at the table?
Yeah, totally. And you really, I think you've hit on what really is the crux of a really good founder and venture capitalist or investor relationship at the early stages of a company. It's just like a marriage, you know. I mean, it's cliche to say, lots of people do, but I'll say it as well because it's true. You know, when you take venture capital, institutional venture capital investment as a startup, you are getting married to those that investor, both as a firm and as the individual people who may be joining your board. But it's even more than getting married. It's like marriage where you can't get divorced. You know, you once you've sold those shares and they're on your capitalization table, you can't just take them back. I mean, you may be able to try to buy them back somehow, but you'd have to get the capital to do that. You'd have to get them to agree. You really can never get rid of them. And just like any marriage, you know, the key to making it work is just constant, really honest communication. It's a lot like, you know, the same things that make co-founding relationships work or not work. But I think what's unlike a co-founder relationship where you're spending every day and working on every aspect of the business with your co-founders, with your VCs, I think what's really important to set up those communication channels around are sort of the more, I would say, month to month or year to year, quarter to quarter progress of the business. And so one thing that is really important to me, and especially, you know, the very early investing that I like to do and I'm doing more of now, is setting and agreeing on milestones for the company upfront, even before we invest, because that's how you can tell if you're aligned or not. And those milestones can be having, you know, an MVP of the product built. They can be, you know, having your first transactions happening on the platform. They can be understanding what a profitable, you know, channel and cost of acquisition is for your customer base, and proving that you can get a positive return on that investment over a given period of time. Or they can be getting to a certain point of scale. It's unique to every business, but I think what's really, really important is that you and your investors are aligned on those milestones, because then you can point to like, hey, here's the progress we're making or not making. Here are the issues we're having and we can work together. But I think where the real danger is you're alluding to and the situations where founders and investors get totally out of whack is when they don't agree on, you know, what that next milestone is that they're trying to hit.
So David, I think an interesting dynamic here could be, I hope that listeners to this podcast and Dave and I's peers will one day be companies that your fund invests in.
So, amen. Amen.
So we, at the risk of pre-selling this a little bit, maybe.
We do, yes. But, we should, you know, if somebody's going to come to, I hope that somebody comes to me someday and says, you know what? I'd like to invest $60 million in your recapture business to help you take some liquidity off the table to improve my enterprise sales. Like, if I got to that point, I'm going to feel pretty damn good about it. Yeah.
So no, it's a very fair point though, but I think for ourselves probably, and a lot of people listening to the show, the question is, you know, kind of what does that look like ideally from your perspective? So kind of, when do you, quote, like to get involved in a business in terms of revenue or degree of product market fit? What is like a perfect situation for you guys to get involved with a business? I guess with the caveat being most people listening to this show either are single founders or bootstrappers that already have a business.
So I think what's really important here is, and actually also comes back to this alignment concept, is to know your audience of who you're talking to at a VC firm, and both in terms of the firm and that person specifically within the firm. What is their sweet spot? Because it's all over the map. I mean, like I was alluding to, you know, for me and for the type of investing I'm doing now, it is impossible to be too early. We want to start working with founders, you know, on day zero when there's just an idea, no product is built, there's no traction. But what we're doing is all of our alignment and incentives with our investors and in terms of the business that we're trying to build is fixated on that moment of time. Whereas there are plenty of other firms, you know, Excel, for instance, being a great example of, they invest much, much later than that point. So even what a firm like Excel or Sequoia or Greylock or any of the other, you know, storied Silicon Valley traditional venture firms, what they consider early stage, you know, from a founder's perspective and probably from any of your audience members' perspective, is actually fairly far along. So they're going to want to see like the product built. They're going to want to see, you know, whatever your business is, plenty of transactions and liquidity happening, so that they can analyze that and determine whether, you know, the data is showing that your company has a lot more room to run. As I was talking about, you know, that there is a reasonable chance that you could grow 10, 20, you know, 100 times more. But it just depends on what the size of the firm is and what their incentives are. And a really good way to tell that, you know, most firms are very transparent about what they're looking for, but it is to look at what the size of the particular fund is that's interested in talking to you. Like, you know, for instance, those big venture firms that I mentioned, you know, their funds are 500 million or a billion or even multiple billions. You know, in those cases, what they've promised their investors is that they're going to return, say it's a $1 billion fund, you know, in 10 years, they're going to give their investors $3 billion back. Well, if you just kind of follow the money and do the reverse math on that, they're going to think, well, okay, they'll have somewhere between 20 and 30 companies that they invest in. And some of those are, you know, they're going to lose their money. But the ones that win, let's assume they own anywhere from 20 to 30% of the company, you know, how much money will I have to exit for to be meaningful to them? And it turns out it's a really high number. Whereas if the firm is more like $20 or $30 million, then commensurately, the number that you would need to exit for as a founder to be meaningful to that firm is going to be much lower.
That makes sense. So let's talk about not just the sweet spot about where you like to get involved with the business, but the stuff that you find out with founders themselves. So of the companies that you've dealt with where you guys come in maybe a little bit later and are dealing with a bootstrap situation where they've got revenue, they've got some product market fit and some traction, what do you see as some of the shortcomings that those founders are struggling with and they're unable to take their business to the next level?
Yeah, great question. Well, I think personally, I believe that every founder is unique. You know, I take the Tolstoy approach. you know, every happy family is you know the same, and every unhappy family is unhappy in their own specific way. Replace unhappy family with founder.
How very Russian of you!
Yeah, and so I don't know that it's necessarily, in general, bootstrapped entrepreneurs versus non-bootstrapped entrepreneurs. But I will say, you know, one element that I have seen in cases where a company maybe waits a little longer to take venture capital and isn't used to that kind of mindset that I was talking about, where you really need to swing big for the fences, is doing things that, or more accurately, not doing things that are sort of aggressively pursuing the largest opportunities. So, like, for instance, one company that I think has probably done this better than anyone over the whole life of the company is Amazon, right? You know, it started as selling books on the internet, but very quickly thereafter, well, first, you know, Bezos and the company pursued that with like incredible, you know, incredible speed and ferocity, really.
Yeah.
Just trying to grow as quickly as possible and become the dominant company in that space. But then what I think they did after that, leading up to the IPO and then even after the IPO and now where we are further, is not stop looking for how do I 10X the business, you know, to go from books to, you know, music and movies to then, you know, other categories to then selling anything to then going to AWS to now going to Alexa. The best entrepreneurs that the biggest and best venture capital firms are looking for are people who have that mindset of, you know, I'm doing great, but how do I do 10x greater no matter what scale I'm at? And I think sometimes that's harder for some bootstrapped entrepreneurs because that's just not the mindset that you're in when you're trying to, you know, I'll take the Atlassian guys, for example. And again, they are great entrepreneurs and have built that business well beyond where it initially started. But their goal when they started was to make enough money in profit for the year that they could pay themselves the equivalent salary as if they were working at a consulting firm right out of college. And I think it was like $45,000 a year or something like that. That's a very different goal than constantly looking for how do I grow this business 10 times over?
Yeah. And I mean, they're a good example of, I mean, they've made tons of acquisitions. And for a bootstrap company, they're probably as close to the Amazons kind of that live in our world, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, they've been very aggressive in their space, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I guess kind of similar to that, but maybe a bit of a contrast is looking at funded business founders, what do you wish you would see out of funded business founders to act more like bootstrap founders? So what are people who've taken money, do they get complacent, or do they change their perspective and make some short-sighted decisions potentially, or what have you seen there that we might all learn from?
Absolutely. I think certainly there, you know, both types of businesses and founders can learn from each other, but I think where we are in the Silicon Valley ecosystem right now, I wish funded founders would take a lot more from the playbook of bootstrap founders. And what I mean by that is, there's just, you know, we are at, I think, the tail end of a moment in venture and Silicon Valley where, you know, I refer to it as the steroid era of startups. Like, companies are just raising so much money, way more than they used to for where they are as a business. And people are taking just such enormous risk. This idea that I was talking about earlier of, as an investor, you're looking for the 10x or 100x opportunity when you invest your money. People are willing to take, you know, such small percentage chances on that right now as investors. And what that creates is these companies that are, and founders that are, if you're good at raising money, and it is definitely, you know, an art that sometimes doesn't have that much to do with your actual business process, business prospects, you can just hugely overcapitalize a business. And then once that money's sitting in your bank account, believe me, the pressure to spend it is immense. You know, if you raise $10 or $20 million and your business is still at the nascent stages, you know, your venture investors who gave you that money, they're going to want you to just to invest that as quickly as possible to grow as big as possible. But you may not have like a, you know, sound business plan to do that. Whereas when you're bootstrapped, you know, by definition, you have to have a viable business plan, you know, every day, because if you don't, you're going to go belly up. And I just really wish that a lot of founders these days, you know, sort of operate and live from round to round. And that's just the round to round of venture capital financing. And that is just absolutely the wrong way to do it versus having a sound business plan for what you're going to do with the money you raise and how it's going to, you know, accrete value to everyone in the company.
Yeah. As soon as you mentioned that whole steroid era, the first thing that popped into my head, you remember Color Labs?
Oh, yes. Oh, what a disaster.
$41 million disaster. Launched it out there. The whole thing was squandered. It was rumored that they could sell to Apple for about $7 million after they were done. It was just a huge facepalm moment. So, yeah, I mean,
what's so paradoxical about that to me is it's often, you know, when you have those funding dynamics in your business, it's actually counterproductive to building a great product and a great business. You know, I think about Instagram, right? When Instagram was acquired by Facebook, which as we know now was still very early on the growth curve, but everybody thought it was, you know, huge. They only had 13 employees, like, and they had burned through very, very little venture capital, or even Stitch Fix, which just recently went public. And I think is in a lot of ways a wake-up call to a lot of Silicon Valley. People are saying like, oh, why isn't Stitch Fix, you know, valued more? I think they're trading at about $1.5 billion market cap right now. Well, they capitalized that business very appropriately and efficiently along the way, and they were profitable pretty much for most of their operating life as a company. And so I think they raised just under $50 million in total, which today that's like, you know, a single Series B. and everybody made a great return. The founders did great. The company has built a really solid company. Whereas if they had raised $300 or $400 or $500 million, you know, it would have been a disappointment for everyone.
But yeah, I mean, there's the unicorn expectation here, right? So that leads me to the next question here, which is, you know, you've talked about the steroid era. So what would you say has changed in the VC landscape the most in the last 3 to 5 years for year? And, here's the real big question that sort of goes with that. Are we coming up on a funding bubble? And what round is that the most risk here? Seed, A, B, pre-IPO, you know, where are companies going to feel this pinch the most in the coming next few years?
Yeah. Well, I think I'm not sure I can speculate on the answer to the second question, but I definitely feel strongly, and the more time I spend in all aspects of the venture capital business, which believe me involves fundraising yourself, not just dispensing money, investing money, but also raising it yourself, it comes back to what I said earlier about follow the money. The reason all of this is happening is that limited partners, LPs, the people that invest in institutional venture capital funds, these are folks, you know, these are university endowments, these are big pension funds, these are foundations. And traditionally, those were the capital providers to the asset class. What's happened over the last 5 years, shall we say, 5 to 7 years, is there is two things. One, even those folks haven't been able to get growth on their capital in other asset classes. So interest rates are, you know, zero to negative in real terms. Public market returns have been okay, but not great. Other asset classes are struggling. They're looking for, you know, places to put 5 or 10% of their asset base that have the chance to, you know, double or triple or 5x that. They have to turn to venture capital. So they're increasing their allocations. But then what's also happened is there are whole new sources of capital that are coming to the industry, particularly sovereign wealth funds. And these are funds and pools of capital that would dwarf, you know, all of the Ivy League endowments combined. And they've decided that they also are looking for growth. And so they've come to Silicon Valley as well and are just pumping huge dollars into many of these firms. That's made
the VC is the new retirement fund. These are everybody's retirement pensions.
Totally. But that all flows down the system back to, you know, this alignment that I was talking about. It's created this environment where as you've raised these large funds, you're looking for the companies that could exit for, you know, not just $1 billion, because the sad truth is that doesn't even move the needle that much on these funds anymore, you know, but $5, $10, $50, $100 billion. And so you're willing to squint more and more and more and take risk on these companies and stuff money into them in chasing those huge returns because you've raised bigger funds. So I think that's the dynamic that's happened. It hasn't been as much of a change on the company side as it has on the dynamics of the capital flowing into the system. Now, where it goes from here, I don't know, because the dynamics are still the same. There's still not reliable sources of growth for capital in other asset classes. You know, interest rates are still very depressed. Public markets investing is picking back up a little bit, but there's just been decimation of the hedge fund space. Buyouts and private equity, I don't know as much about that, but the return profile just isn't as high. To be honest, I wish I could say otherwise, but I don't see it stopping anytime soon, which I think is going to create just further funding of private companies and lack of liquidity in the ecosystem.
Yeah, I think it provides some maturity to the market too, right? So just more data and more clear expectations probably on both sides of the fence, right?
Well, it does.
As the road kind of continues as it is?
Well, as the road continues, it does, but ultimately, even these sovereign wealth funds that have very, very long time horizons, they are eventually going to want those dollars realized as returns. and that's becoming more and more of an issue over time as these companies keep raising larger rounds in the private markets and then staying private longer, and then there's no liquidity. And next thing you know, you have billions of dollars locked up in Uber or, some of the other large companies out there.
Gotcha. So, David, I wanted to ask about types of businesses that you find particularly appealing. So over here on the other side of the pond, I follow the guys at Point Nine Capital pretty closely.
Yep.
And they are big into SaaS, and they're also big into marketplaces, of which I have involvement in SaaS directly right now, and I have this sort of veiled excitement about the marketplace world that I have not gotten into yet, but think it would be fascinating to explore the dynamics of it. As a bootstrapper, I don't know if it's possible, but where do you see marketplaces fitting into kind of this sharing economy that we're definitely into now? And kind of what do you think the dynamics are for marketplaces here in kind of the tail end of 2017?
Yeah, absolutely. And marketplaces are a huge, huge focus for me and for what we're doing now. I would say, here's how we think about marketplaces. Certainly, you've seen many consumer marketplaces be very successful. You know, Airbnb, Uber, despite all the capital they've raised, has certainly transformed the transportation market. Rover in its own way has transformed, you know, many aspects of the pet market. And as we think about it, we see what's enabled all of that is that when you build a marketplace, what's really cool is that you have essentially infinite variation of what the product experience is that you can offer to the supply and demand side. And what I mean by that is, like, let's take Airbnb, for example. So if you wanted to build a hotel, you could build a very nice hotel, but you would have to build it to serve a very particular target customer segment. Like, you're either building a Ritz-Carlton or you're building, like, you know, an Econo-Lodge or something in between.
Yep.
You can only serve that one type of customer. What's beautiful about marketplaces is that you can serve every type of customer. So on Airbnb, you know, I can get a room, you know, a space on somebody's couch in a big city for, you know, $30 a night. Or I could rent, you know, the most exquisite castle, you know, in the world for, you know, multiple thousands of dollars a night. And those are super different, both supply side and demand side audiences that I'm serving, but Airbnb can very efficiently serve both of them. And so as we think about marketplaces, we think about, like, what are all the variety of transactions out there, both on the consumer side and on the business to business side, where if you had a platform that could meet all different types of segments, you know, how could you revolutionize that? So I think there are many, many more to be built. A lot have been built on the consumer side, but there's some great ones coming up on the enterprise. I mean, relevant to the podcasting space, I think Patreon is super interesting. I don't know if you guys have explored that, but it's a platform for makers and creators of podcasts or art or music to allow to find supporters of that content. So rather than, you know, PBS, right? Like, PBS can only produce so much content that's going to appeal to so many different people. But on something like Patreon, you can have creators of all different types and patrons of all different types who want to support them, and they can meet each other in the marketplace.
Yeah, I think marketplaces are so interesting because they are, like you said, transformative in a lot of ways. And the technology of it is not always super complicated, but it's understanding both sides of the market really well and what everybody's trying to get out of it. I think it's great as a consumer that participates in a lot of marketplaces to see how it's changing a lot of things you do. I mean, we've traveled extensively with our family here in Europe and stayed at some amazing places for half of what we could stay in a hotel for at Airbnbs. It's just amazing. It's wonderful.
And the key often to doing it is real depth of understanding of the transaction. And what I mean by that is that, like you said, it's often not that challenging to actually build the technology behind these platforms. But what Airbnb realized really early on that none of their competitors ever really got in the same way they did is that they weren't building, you know, a hospitality platform. They were building a trust platform. Like, the issue, the key to unlocking it all and making it work was, you know, you have to trust, as you and your family are traveling around Europe, that the places you're staying, you know, don't have serial killers in them. And how can you do that? And every market has similar dynamics, and figuring out what it is that is going to create the willingness to transact on both sides and change behavior is often the key to getting it started.
This is why Craigslist sort of cracked the classifieds market, but didn't really take it all the way, because trust was immediately destroyed when people were trying to go in there and, you know, buy and sell stuff on there. And then scammers came in and took advantage of people. And there was no mechanism that Craigslist had built into it to allow people to do that. But now you've got other people that are building that in for buying and selling stuff. Yeah. You know, that was what made eBay way more successful than Craigslist, absolutely, in my opinion.
That was a huge part of why PayPal was so important to eBay.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, because that definitely adds that whole trust factor in there if you've got online payments that you can rely on at that point.
Yep. So we find marketplaces totally fascinating, intellectually, but also just in terms of, like, the scale of impact they can have. Because if you get it right, you know, like I was saying, you can literally win the entire market in a way that when you're just building a specific product is very hard to do.
Indeed. So, taking a step back from everything that you've seen on both sides of the VC founder relationship at this point, let's say you had somebody coming to you to say, I'd like to start a new business today. Would you advise them to seek funding early or to try to bootstrap and come back? Or would the answer depend on what idea they had that they brought to you?
Unsurprisingly, I'd say it would depend. But I think the first thing that I would advise them to do is think about what their goals are, both personally in terms of why are you personally starting this business? What do you hope to achieve? And that's very different things for different people. I mean, again, they grew much past this over time, but when the Atlassian founders started Atlassian, they just wanted to pay themselves $45,000 a year. and that is not well aligned with raising venture capital. Now, they obviously evolved past that, but personally, and then after that, I would start there, but then after that, start with the business and say, okay, what to build the type of business that I want to build in this market? What are the goals and milestones, as I was saying, that I need to achieve, and how quickly do I need or want to achieve them? And that should inform, you know, how you approach thinking about funding, both in terms of when you think about funding, but also how and from whom. So, you know, for us, what we'd love to see are those business plans, you know, and I don't mean a formal, you know, document like you would make in business school or 10 years ago. It's so funny how, you know, Silicon Valley and
that's
raising
so
venture
school.
Capital. Yeah. You know, it used to be that you would create a business plan. Now you just make a PowerPoint deck or a keynote deck, but the same thinking behind it needs to go into it. And what you can accomplish with the dollars that you want to raise is such a key input. So like for us, you know, if focusing on marketplaces, you know, if you can demonstrate that on whatever amount of capital you need, you think there's a path to starting to create a platform and solving the kind of key problem that I was talking about, you know, which isn't just the surface level, but like in Airbnb's case was trust, you know, showing a business plan to do that. Absolutely. Like whenever that is, whether that's day zero or day one or day 1,000, like that's the right time to approach us.
Interesting. And sort of practically to tack onto that, as a founder already has some sort of level of business going, what sort of practical things should we have aligned or kind of in a row before we start talking to venture capitalists or investors of any kind?
Yeah, well, I think with a business that's already running, a deep understanding of the economics around your business. So how do you find customers and how much does it cost you to acquire them? And then once they transact, what's your cost to serve them and what, you know, what gross contribution are you able to get out of that transaction? And how does that feed into the business as it's scaling? So being able to understand that is just super important for managing the business yourself, but then being able to articulate that to an investor is, I think for an existing business, probably the most important part. But I would also say, you know, approach just like, you know, I talked in the beginning about, you know, taking investment being like a marriage. You know, I would approach the fundraising process in the same way that I would approach dating, which is like, you probably don't want to marry the very first person that you go out on a date with. You want to go date a lot of people and understand, you know, what their traits are and who's the best fit for you and who you're going to be able to build a great life together with. I would encourage founders to approach VC, you know, in the exact same way. And it's both a learning process in terms of, like I said, who the best fit is for you, but also for you, who you are. You know, oftentimes some of those questions I was talking about of what are your goals, what do you want to achieve with the business, both personally and in terms of the larger entity, it can be hard to think of those in a vacuum. And a lot of times a fundraising process can really force you to grapple with those questions. So I would just make sure you allocate enough time and mind space to do it.
Great marriage and business advice all in one. This is Dave, we're hitting it out of the park with that. Oh, that's great. That's wonderful stuff. Yeah.
Yes. All right. So does that mean if we're going to go with the dating analogy, I have to bring this up. Does that mean that there's a Tinder for VCs somewhere where I can just keep swiping right on all the VC firms and hope that somebody comes back to me and says, yeah, let's hook up for a night, you know?
It's funny you ask. I mean, in a certain way, you know, AngelList was trying to do that. And I don't mean that in a pejorative way. I think it was really ambitious. I think what that has proven to be less successful than Tinder because people realize once you could go on a Tinder date, but you don't have to see the person again. Once you go on a AngelList date, you know, you kind of have to deal with that person for the rest of your company's life.
right.
But I do think there are all sorts of different platforms to get introduced and interact with investors.
Nice. Nice. All right. So as a wrap up question here, just throwing this out there, because I follow Jason Calcanis on Twitter, and he's very, very opinionated about this, and some other folks that are out there as well. What's your take on ICOs and cryptocurrency?
I almost brought this up when you asked about the Tinder for for investing. I don't know enough to say. I mean, you know, one issue for sure is that like it's not actual equity that you're talking about, and so how that will play out over time, and in terms of value and security in the security, is still very much the jury is out. But that said, you know, if the kinks get worked out of the platform and there is real confidence that's enabled both for founders in terms of, you know, the capital you're taking and the partners you're bringing on, and for investors in terms of the security that you're getting, you know, bringing more openness and transparency and availability and liquidity to funding markets is great. I mean, that's a marketplace, right? So I'm very excited about the future of it, but I think we still have a long way to go in terms of installing the right infrastructure to get there. So I would not advise founders to, especially early stage founders, to, you know, think about doing an ICO as your best funding route right now. In a couple of years, I hope so, but there's still a lot of peril right now.
Ah, there goes my plans to invest in Paris Hilton's Lydian coin.
You gotta start doing real work, Dave.
I hope I save some money.
God, I thought I was so close to just being a multi-billionaire. I read all the prospectuses; they promised it was going to happen. Oh, I mean, God. What could possibly go wrong?
What could go wrong?
Oh yeah.
Awesome.
All right,
David. Thank you so much for a wonderful chat and some really interesting insights. Can you share with folks where they can learn more about you and what you're up to?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm on LinkedIn as David Rosenthal. I'm on Twitter, DJRosent. But probably the best place to find me is over at the Acquired Podcast. And Ben and I release an episode about every 2 weeks, and we have a Slack group. We have over 1,000 people in the Slack, and people chatting about all sorts of tech events and M&A and IPOs. And so you can get in touch with me just directly through DM in the Slack group there.
Cool. And that's acquired.fm, right?
Acquired.fm.
Awesome. David Rosenthal, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
And if anybody has any questions, follow-up questions for David about VC bootstrapping or how you can get into Lydian coin. Actually, don't ask about Lydian coin. You can email us at podcast@roguestartups.com. And if you're liking the show, we'd love it if you could leave us a review in iTunes. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Rogue Startups. If you haven't already, head over to iTunes and leave a rating and review for the show. For show notes from each episode and a few extra resources to help you along your journey, head over to roguestartups.com to learn more.